When I was young, I learned that love was all about romantic comedies, Valentine's Day, chocolate, and flowers. A lot of capitalist, heterosexual BS. Now, I know that real love is ferocious, it's terrifying, and it's a catalyst for change. I'm Ethan Lipsitz, and I created Love Extremist Radio as a platform to engage with people who are on the front lines of wrestling with and redefining love on their terms. They're activists, artists, and creators, all making change in their communities and the world. Thanks for being here. Together, let's define what it means to be a love extremist.
Love is the truth. Love is the truth. Love is the truth. Love is the truth.
Paul Kivel, social justice educator, activist, and writer, has been an innovative leader in violence prevention for more than 45 years. He is an accomplished trainer and speaker on men's issues, racism and diversity, challenges of youth, teen dating and family violence, raising boys to manhood, and the impact of class and power on daily life. His work gives people the understanding to become involved in social justice work and the tools to become more effective allies in community struggles to end oppression and injustice and to transform organizations and institutions. Kivel is the author of numerous books and curricula, including Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, which won the 1996 Gustavus Myers Award for Best Book on Human Rights, Men's Work, Making the Peace, Helping Teens Stop Violence, Boys Will Be Men, I Can Make My World a Safer Place, and most recently, You Call This a Democracy, Who Benefits, Who Pays, and Who Really Decides, and most recently, Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. Wow. You are really expansive in your breadth of impact in terms of the issues that you face and the things that you write about. I'm curious as to how this pandemic is bringing up and surfacing some of these challenges for you or some of these issues in your perspective, Paul. And welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be talking with you today. The pandemic, I think, it brings to sharp focus a lot of the issues I've been talking about over the years and working and organizing around and writing about. The concentration of wealth and power and in our ruling class and corporate elite and how that impacts our lives. Mm. We can see this with how the government's functioning and how the bailouts and relief packages are set up, et cetera. The role of white supremacy as a core piece of our society and the way that people of color are particularly dramatically impacted by the pandemic and most vulnerable.
Definitely.
The way that women are particularly impacted, again, by the pandemic, both as frontline workers and as caretakers for not only our young people, but often for our elders, for people with disabilities, both paid and unpaid. And we could go on that the systems of oppression and marginalization and exploitation in our society are exacerbated in times of crisis. And we can see on one hand how people with power and wealth are trying to take advantage of that. And on the other hand, that so many people now in our local communities are building networks of mutual aid, are reaching out to folks trying to decarcerate our jails and prisons and deportation centers and trying to address the issues that make people vulnerable and that lead to chronic vulnerability.
Yeah. I was going to ask kind of as a follow-up, for those of us who see this as maybe not a vacation, but who have comfortable places to live and maybe have some work or still have access to resource, what are the best ways for us to support those who are really struggling in this moment, maybe more so than they normally would? And certainly there are mutual aid groups set up all over the country, and that has been an amazing resource I've noticed. But are there other things that you have directed your attention to that you think are really effective in supporting people at this time?
I think that one of the things that those of us who do have more privileges and security in this time have to realize is that security has been built over the decades and often generations out of because of systems which have exploited some people and benefited the rest others of us.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore that we are kind of intimately connected to everybody in our community, and that we have a responsibility to take our those benefits and support and figure out ways to work in the mutual interest of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that can be direct. I mean, there's a Share the Check campaign nationally about those of us who are getting stimulus checks to find local organizations to or national organizations that are redistributing those checks to those who have been left out of the stimulus package. Other ways are to support local organizations building mutual aid networks. You know, depending upon who we are and how old we are and how many family obligations we have and how much economic resources we have, we each have to take stock of our assets and our connections and our resources and say, okay, how can I reach out to people in my community, my neighborhood, my city, and show up in this time, not just fall back and say, well, I'm comfortable and I've got a safe place and I've got a backyard, I can go outside and take care of myself, but how do I actually reach out and become part of the community efforts to not just to address the immediate crisis, but to also address the long-term systems that build in the kind of vulnerability that we're seeing today.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, is how can we come out of this stronger and start to recognize if this catalyzed your awareness, great. Now let's do something about that, right? If we're just starting to recognize these massive inequalities that have been here for so long and are baked into this country's founding, you know, how can we start to act on that? I do want to double click on the mutual aid. What's great, I have a mutual aid group coming to pick up a box of masks that I have and some lemons from my tree in the back and some other resources that I have. And, you know, you'd be surprised what they're looking for, right? So if you get on a listserv and you say what you have to give, they'll often take it. And that's a really powerful way to support people in need. And you might be surprised as to maybe it's not money you have, but maybe it's an abundant lemon tree or some extra clothes that you need to get rid of or something like that. So.
Right. And there's also ways to be active over the phone in supporting efforts to actually decarcerate our society and to provide support. You know, there's letters we can write, there's phone calls we can make, there's emails we can send. We can actually join efforts with others to amplify our voices to shape the response to the pandemic, but also to be building towards a post-pandemic society that we all want to live in.
Absolutely. What are some of those places where people can get more information in terms of calling and using their voice?
Well, I think that it varies across the country, but I'm part of a national group called Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, mm-hmm. which is particularly focused on educating and mobilizing white people. And on the website, there are times during the week when people get together virtually and make phone calls and write letters and work together on these kinds of things. So that's a national opportunity. And then I know locally, I live on Chichonia Ohlone land here in Oakland, California. In the Bay Area here, there is lots of opportunities for folks to do that kind of work together with others, sponsored by local grassroots organizations. So people need to look locally as well as nationally for these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And there's also been just the appearance of immense tragedy and brutality and ultimately white supremacy and death at the hands of white folk, often police or former police lately. And, you know, thinking about Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and wanting to reach out, there's many opportunities for us to keep them and their cases just and fair. And that requires phone calls and emails and reaching out to people. It's not just, you know, the hashtag posting is one component, but it's a very small one. It really requires our voice to be heard. And especially as white people, we have an opportunity to stand up for Black lives in that way.
Right. And money is always needed. So we also have to not just raise our voices, but also open our pocketbooks and in this time and really share the wealth.
Yeah. So I'm curious to actually dig in there in terms of your relationship with money. I know that you have written a lot on class and power and how that those dynamics are experienced in daily life. And I wonder, as someone who has been involved in this work for so long, how you've come to terms with capitalism and how you relate to kind of right livelihood and what is enough.
That's a big question. I'll start by just saying that I haven't come to terms with capitalism.
Okay.
I think it's the part of the foundation of the systems of exploitation and violence that we live within. Mm-hmm. It has been the motor that has fueled Native American genocide and slavery, and today the horrendous working conditions of so many people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, we have to accept that we're all inside this system. There's no special place to stand outside of the dominant economic system. So, no, that means that there's no way that we're not participating and supporting it in some ways, either through our taxes or our labor or through various other ways that we interact with it. And it also means that we have lots of choices each day about how we do that and what we support and where we put our money, where we put our energy and time. I come from a family that benefited tremendously from white male privilege. My father had, and grandfather and great-grandfather had, lots of opportunities for education and jobs and housing based upon their being white male and access to those basic necessities being denied to so many people at the same time, so that they were able to buy houses at lower rates when other people couldn't buy houses at all and get into schools that only white men could get into, if it's just for some examples.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I've inherited a life built on exploitation, in particular, even though my family only immigrated here 120 years ago, which, you know, they didn't come over on the Mayflower, but they still, even in recent generations, enjoy tremendous advantages.
Right.
So I try to think about my, you know, the totality of my time and energy and money and things like that, and the needs of my family and the work that my partner does, and to put together, you know, livelihoods for both of us that make sense, that don't feel too compromised, but also have components of public service and activism involved in them. Realizing that there's no, like I said, no pure place to be in the society. but we do make lots of choices around that. And to be really attentive to how class and economics play out in our community, in our family, in our workplaces.
Right.
And also to think about livelihood more than just in terms of paid work, but also in unpaid work. Mm-hmm. You know, where does our charitable, our donations go? Where does our volunteer time go? Not just in terms of service, but in terms of social justice, supporting not just organizations that are, you know, providing food or shelter for folks in need, but are working on issues of hunger and housing and economic justice as well.
And do you find yourself in between kind of giving time and serving those in need on a kind of volunteer basis as well as professionally? Because obviously you've written a lot of books and you've created curricula. I imagine there's income that's been generated through those processes. Do you kind of have a certain division of how you approach labor in regards to social justice or versus making a living?
Well, I don't think there's an easy formula there. My partner and I, you know, very intentional about giving at least a certain percentage of our income back to the community, and using our time and energy to support community efforts in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
My work primarily has focused on social justice, so mostly everything I've done, paid or unpaid, it has been through that lens, whether it's trainings and workshops or the books I've written or the organizations that I work with. It's, you know, being an ally is a practice, and each day we make decisions about all of these aspects of our life,
mm-hmm.
and we have to be making them with a social justice lens, because otherwise our dominant Christian and capitalist society push us towards individualism, competition, exclusion, segregation, and, you know, away from what I think for most of us are our core values.
Mm-hmm. So if we can find work that aligns with values and stands for justice, that's a great thing, because...
And we can work for justice in our workplaces.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great point. Right. There's no shortage of inequities that we can find right at home or right wherever we spend our days. And
exactly.
Always opportunities to make an impact in that way. That's true. So this is Love Extremist Radio, and I'd love to hear from you how you define love.
I'm not sure I have a definition of love. You know, people have talked about love in lots of different ways and different kinds of love, sexual love, intimate love, platonic love, love of one's neighbor, all kinds of different things. And so it's a word that I find is fairly problematic. It's difficult to use because people hear it in so many different ways. My takeaway in general is that behind all these different definitions or levels that people talk about, there is a basic understanding of the unity of all life and everything in the world, that there's a basic understanding of the wholeness, how everything fits together, and a basic understanding of the oneness of it all. That often we're talking about those kinds of things, those deeper levels of our lives when we talk about love. So I don't have a definition for it, but those are some of the aspects that I think are involved for me when I use the word.
Mm.
And I think what's problematic is that, like I mentioned, we live in a highly individualistic society, and so we tend to think of love as something we do or have towards somebody else or something. Getting out of that individualism towards a sense of, first of all, an awareness of the interconnectedness of things, and moving towards understanding of our interdependence with all life, and then finally towards our oneness with everything, is kind of the path from that individual love to more what we might call a spiritual level of love and understanding of how the universe operates.
Mm-hmm. I'm really fascinated by that awareness and that connection to oneness. How did you start to become aware or learn or realize that we're all not only interdependent but one? What's catalyzed that for you?
I think it's been a long, slow process of knowing and seeing at deeper and deeper levels how much I am connected to not just my family or my neighborhood or my city, but to everybody and to all the life forms on the planet and to the Earth itself. And the pandemic makes that so real, but we've had lots of crises during my lifetime in which our wholeness, our oneness, our interconnectedness has been very, very obvious to me. Just on the human level, you know, I look at what I had for breakfast or lunch, the coffee or tea or chocolate or bananas or oranges. I look at who made my clothes in the various countries of the world and the conditions under which they're working. I look at my cell phone and computer and I think about who makes that and under what conditions and what wars are going on, struggling over the minerals that go into those things. I mean, just anything I pay attention to. So you might call this a form of mindfulness, reminds me of how interdependent I am with with everything.
Mm. Can you share a couple other moments that the pandemic is maybe reminding you of in terms of times when that oneness showed up, maybe on a national or an international level, that feeling of human connectedness?
Well, I mean, mostly it's in the response of so many people in terms of mutual aid.
Mm-hmm.
And people reaching out to take care of neighbors or people in their city or in various ways. I think that comes from that deep understanding of interdependence and mutuality.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in thinking about the climate change and the impact we're having on the planet and the planet's having on us and the relationship between the climate emergency and the pandemic and the other pandemics we faced recently, makes it clear that we can't ignore our interdependence and the mutuality of our connections to the natural world as well.
Right. Yeah, I think there were unfortunate results around sometimes that awareness that have come out of tragedies like 9/11, right? Where we saw this rise in patriotism and national pride that ultimately led to an exclusionary and war pro-war effort as it related to Muslim people and countries and invading the Middle East. I wonder if there's this sense of oneness, it almost feels like it could tip in either direction. It could move more deeply towards oppression and war and trauma, or it could come out into a space of almost renaissance and healing. And I don't know, have there been other times in your life history when you saw that kind of oneness and people coming together in service to the world or their communities in a meaningful way, and that led to a renaissance, that led to a better living conditions for people?
Well, I think it's hard to make any kind of generalizations. I think that, like I said, most of us start out or are raised in this culture to be very individualistic and self-serving and to care about those who are only care about those who are closest to us. So the path to that greater love or that greater understanding of our oneness and interdependence is something that we develop. And in times of crisis, we have a ruling class and that is quick to use those crises as opportunities to enhance their power and wealth. And so they feed the worst parts of that. They feed the individualism, the competition, the scapegoating of immigrants and people of color and whoever they can. And at the same time, most of us have a deep sense of caring about others and fairness and are, you know, leaning in one direction but being pulled in the other. And so it comes somewhat back to our individual choices we make and the kind of support that we have in our communities for reaching out and taking care of each other. Because ultimately, the only thing that will keep us safe and healthy is collective caring, not individual caring.
Mm-hmm. How do you teach that? I know that you've been involved in education and creating curriculum around this issue. Like, how do we create a collectivist mentality for this new time?
Well, I don't have any simple answers to that or any magic dust. But, you know, young children, and I mean by that, I mean those who are 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, have a deep sense of caring about other people and connection and a sense of fairness. And so it's not hard at those ages to actually build cultures in our classrooms and families where young people learn how to implement that, how to actually live according to those values. Those of us who are...
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say, for those of us who are older, we have to unlearn a lot of the socialization that we've had in our society. And that's an effort that over the years, some of us have developed curricula that tries to do exactly that. And sometimes it's very effective, but it has to be an intentional effort to bring people together across differences and really address some of these root beliefs and behaviors.
Mm. What I was going to say is it seems as though, you know, we get into kind of middle school age, the next, you know, set of years after, you know, 5, 6, then you get into kind of 7, 8, 9, 10, 13. And those differences that we have start to become more apparent. And I don't know if it's, I mean, obviously socialization plays a huge role in this, but I'm sure there's also some kind of natural tendencies for us to, you know, have that moment of stepping into adulthood. You know, in the Jewish tradition, it's age 13, right? And there's these kind of coming of age rituals that historically we may have had. And they would have been for in service to the community and the collective, but also in kind of strengthening the individual. But these days, it's really all about the individual, as you said. I wonder if that's also a moment that we can start to kind of pinpoint, because, yeah, we have these values innate when we're young, and then it's almost as if we're socialized out of them through competition and through... just noticing differences, right? I wasn't as conscious of my white privilege until, you know, maybe 10 or 11 when it was like, like I'm no longer hanging out with the people who I was spending time with before.
Well, we know that the young children notice difference and they make meaning out of that difference. So it's not that younger children don't notice differences, but they still are more in touch with at least most of them are more in touch with those impulses to care about other people and be sensitive when people are harmed and, you know, to build community that way. You know, as we move on, we're moving through institutions like schools and after-school programs and summer camps and even our families that are not emphasizing those values, but in fact practicing counter values to that and promoting competition and individualism. Our schools are a great example of how that a tremendous socialization process in the wrong direction for most young people.
Right.
Yeah, I think that there's always ways to raise these issues, have these discussions, and work with people to build community. But it has to be age appropriate, and it has to be recognizing that one of the things that people lose is their voice, either as individuals or communities, as they move up, as they grow up. And if we're not listening to young people, then they don't have a chance to feel like real participants in our society. They don't have a chance to feel confident and active in caring about other people and making a difference. And so we have, part of the core of our work has been looking at that, what we call adultism, the kind of systematic disempowerment and violence and exclusion and marginalization that young people face in our society. And that sets them up to be, you know, to accept other systems of oppression based on race and gender and ability and disability and things like that.
That's really interesting. I can relate to that. I definitely felt as a kid excluded from a lot of things, even if it was, you know, from things that my brother and his friends were doing because they were a few years older, but also just, no, you're too young or you're too small or, you know, you can't do that. And it often felt unfair. It felt unjust. And I felt capable and wanting to participate in whatever it was that would upset me. And that does set you up for a little bit of like an, you know, kind of being shut down, and there's also something about individualism in elevating one's voice, right? Like I think of being a creative person and being an artist and how much I value that side of myself, and I'm trying to kind of hold both truths, that I love my artistry and my individual nature, and I want to be part of a collective and I want to give to that collective and make art in service to the world. And so it's this kind of both and feeling of my individualism holds value and my voice as an individual holds value for the group, for everybody. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we are individuals and it's important to honor that. And individualism is the overemphasis on the importance of ourselves as individuals and our isolation and separation from other people.
I see. Got it. So how does your identity as a Jewish man play a role in your activism? Do you find that it shows up a lot or is not as much of a present part of your life?
It shows up pretty substantially, partly because my life is informed by the Jewish culture coming out of Europe, especially Eastern Europe. You know, Jewish culture is vast and diverse, and comes from a lot of different parts of the world. So I can only speak to my particular family trajectory. You know, there's a lot of teachings within Judaism, in the sacred texts of our tradition that, talk about justice and talk about giving back to the community. We have, concepts like tikkun olam and
tzedakah.
Tzedakah.
Yeah.
Tzedakah.
Yeah.
And And so, and there's a long history of Jews working not only for our community survival, but also working with other community folks to resist oppression and tyranny. So that is part of where I come from and what it informs me. Hmm. It also, my family fled Eastern Europe because of the Russian pogroms, the mass attacks on Jewish people.
Mine did too.
And then, of course, some of our family was killed in the Jewish Holocaust. So I also have, you know, family history around the impact of genocide and mass violence and exploitation. And that gives me some, not just motivation, but responsibility to be trying to work against that happening to other people as well.
Mm, that's beautiful. And I relate. I mean, I have a similar family history and see those values showing up. I also see the values of recognizing the oneness of love, but also of, you know, God, right? The Jewish being a monotheistic religion, but also having this kind of overarching relationship to the divine being both an external and an internal entity, and kind of having having its sphere of influence almost be everywhere. And I think that relates to this conversation about love we were having earlier. And I see that tying into Jewish belief in some way.
Uh-huh. Yes, definitely.
So as white men, what role do you think we should be playing in dismantling oppressive systems? And beyond just what role, how should we be showing up?
That's a big question. I think that there are two central roles that white men and in general allies can play in doing social justice work. For white men, one of those roles is to be acting in solidarity with people on the front lines of grassroots struggles for justice. So as a white person, that means looking to people of color-led organizations, people of color in leadership, women in leadership, queer and trans people in leadership, people with disabilities in leadership, marginalized communities, and mm-hmm. and listening to what they're saying their primary needs are, what issues are central to their survival, and showing up in solidarity with that. And there's that means leveraging our resources. Mm-hmm. So whether it's money or time or energy or connections or experience or skills, figuring out how to show up to support the efforts that they are already involved with and taking leadership around to transform our communities. Mm-hmm. So the second level of work, I think, and this is something that people of color and women and others have been asking for from white men forever, is to educate and mobilize other white men. Mm-hmm. And that means reaching out to the white men around us and white men more generally, and doing the educational work to help men understand, or white men understand in particular, you know, how we've been socialized, how sexism and racism and other systems of oppression work, and what kind of skills and work do we need to do to get ready to show up in multiracial, cross-gender, cross-class alliances working for justice.
How do you do that when you're working with a group of white men who might really not want to confront their privilege or may not see the value in stepping into the conversation or have a lot of fear around stepping into the conversation or being more engaged?
Well, that describes most white men, I think.
Yep.
Not wanting to, fearful, hesitant.
Right.
You know, if particular white men are locked into a belief system that makes them impervious to outside influence, then I'm not trying to transform them or spend hours, days, or weeks converting them to some kind of social justice agenda. But for most white men, I've found that, in fact, it's a very isolating place to be a white man in our society. And it leads to a lot of frustration, pain, anger, hurt. It leads to a lot of violence in our lives. And it's a very lonely place.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there is the opportunity for a somewhat safe space for white men to come together and talk about their lives and what's going on, they're actually hungry for these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that they generally just do not feel safe talking to anybody about.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step really is reaching out and creating some space and opening up the conversations, breaking the silence in white male communities about what's going on in our lives and what it's cost us and what it's done to the people around us. And that's really a deep look at male socialization, what we've called over the years coming out of the Oakland Men's Project the Act Like a Man box, the set of expectations to be tough, aggressive, in charge, don't make mistakes, be successful, and hide the pain, don't show your feelings, and never, ever ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of core dominant expectations for men in this society.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the work has to be really looking at that and realizing how much it costs us to be in that box, how much pain and of harm it's done to those around us, and to be working with others to kind of step out of the box.
It's such an important piece of the puzzle, I find, because I find a lot of men on paper and in first blush are excited to have these conversations with me and or others, right? And they you know, don't want to be racist, or you know, they want to learn about how to be more engaged. And they do feel isolated and lonely at times. But as soon as it starts to ask of their time or attention and distract them from their livelihood or their primary purpose focus, it becomes kind of basically, no, I don't have the time. I can't devote my attention to this, or, you know, I'm interested in the issue, but I really just have to focus on my work. I have to focus on, you know, what's bringing in the money right now, or, you know, what my passion is. And yeah, I think that's been a roadblock in my experience amongst, and I guess a lot of the company I keep are men who are entrepreneurial and starting their own projects and really are led by their passions. So their work is their identity in many cases. And so, I don't know how to kind of continue on with some of those guys, but I do recognize, if they're really tied to that identity and aren't really ready to make shifts in their attention to focus on these issues, it might not be the right time. I also, though, see those who are really working hard to dismantle that box that you were talking about, the traditional masculinity box, and create more safe spaces for men to be vulnerable and men to be in relation with each other. And yet those spaces are predominantly white. And so I think that they're struggling with creating diverse environments for men to engage and actually look at social justice as well as the issue of patriarchy and what that means for just the male psyche and men in general. So I don't know. There's a couple things that I've been struggling with, and I don't know if you have thoughts around that, but wanted to share in case you do.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I think that the male, looking at the male socialization piece, the Act Like a Man box, is only one piece of the work that we need to do as men, as white men together. Another piece is to look at how we've benefited, what we might call male privilege, but it's certainly a set of benefits that we gain from being white men at the expense of the women and men and women of color and queer and trans folks around us. And so if we're not putting that male socialization into a broader framework of race, class, and gender, then we're not really doing the work, and we're not going to be motivating men to move, step out into the community, and to become more active in, you know, collective efforts for justice. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, often men's work stops with that men getting together and being vulnerable and, you know, building relationships with other men like them.
Right.
But it doesn't actually get to that, well, how have we benefited from this socialization, and who have we harmed in our lives, and how does it show up in our relationships with women, and how does it segregate us from people of color, just as some examples.
Yeah.
And then we also have to look at that, those kind of interlocking systems of oppression within us, the economic framework, and how did we grow up economically? What was the class background we come from, and what did that teach us, and where are we now, and what kind of values are we acting out of? And so it's more complicated than mostly we assume, and it's not just getting the conversations going, but it's actually going to deeper, broader levels, so that there's a real understanding of our, again, coming back to what we started talking about, our interdependence, our mutuality, our the fact that our lives, not only are we interdependent on with other people, but our very benefits that we take for granted are based on the exploitation of other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the area where I think a lot of the men's work that I've come in contact has fallen short. It's really been about optimizing our relationships, right? Our familial connections, our ability to make money, right? Our ability to be good partners and friends, and to be more vulnerable and in connection with the people that we can trust or that we hold close, maybe our families. And that can do some good for a lot of men in terms of opening them up to more emotional vulnerability and connection within their existing communities. But it doesn't get them looking at their relationship to the world and to the oppressions that we have perpetuated as white men for so long. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of the place of need in my experience with men's work that I'm really fascinated with, and you know, we'll talk more about that offline, I'm sure. But yeah, it's an area that I hope to do more work in.
Great.
Yeah, thank you for articulating that, though. So, where can people find you? What's the best place to go? Is your website the spot?
The website has lots of resources. So it is paulkivel.com, mm-hmm. And that's pretty straightforward. My email address is paul@paulkivel.com.
Awesome.
So I'm also easy to find there.
Cool.
I work a lot with SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice, a national network. So I can also be connected through there. But SURGE's website has a lot of resources as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also part of an emerging national men's network called Organizing White Men for Collective Liberation. So if there's white men listening to this, that's a place. There's a website and a lot of resources and some guidelines for thinking about the work, but also reaching out to other men and pulling together a group and starting the conversation in your local community and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I signed up for that, and I'm really looking forward to getting those resources to begin. So thank you for putting me onto that. Mm-hmm. And what else would you like to share before we wrap up? I just want to make space for, you know, is there anything else you'd like to share in this time to people who are interested in these conversations about love and liberation and wanting to be better stewards of the world and their communities? What thoughts or stories or inspiration comes up for you?
I think that what I would say is that all too often the conversations around love and right livelihood and interpersonal relationships is seen as a separate conversation than the conversations around exploitation and violence and justice. And I think Cornel West said it well. His words were something like, justice is how love shows up in public. Mm. And it's just, we have to understand that just our work for justice has to be based on our love for people, for the planet. And our love needs to be based on a concept of justice and fairness and healing and opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important and such an important component of this podcast is that recognition of, sorry, my dog is barking in the background.
Bonnie, come here.
Anyway, that recognition is so important to think about love beyond just our personal relationships and just our families and how we can bring love into society and what that looks like. And I think Cornel is right on the nose there in terms of justice being what that looks like.
Exactly. And there's no time like now in this pandemic, in this global climate emergency, for us, especially if we're white men and are feeling disconnected or uncertain or unclear what to do, to step out and take some risks and make some connections and find an organization to work with, and to really step up, because we need everybody on the front lines at this point.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, I'm going to post those links to your site and to Surge and to Organizing White Men for Collective Liberation on the podcast notes so people can access that easily. And definitely want to share. I love your website. I've been reading through a lot of your writing, and I really appreciate the work that you've done, and just learning a lot from talking to you and getting to know you. So I want to thank you for making time for this conversation and sharing your experience and your wisdom with us. To take us out, do you have a favorite love song?
I don't know if I have a favorite one. One I like a lot is Stevie Wonder's Love's in Need of Love Today.
Oh, nice.
Because it bridges this gap between the public and the private. And it's just a beautiful song about what we need, the kind of love we need today.
Stevie Wonder is hands down the most mentioned love song artist on this podcast. So I'm glad this is a new one, though. I haven't played this one yet, so I'm excited to listen to it and play it. And that sounds exactly right. So we'll leave it to Stevie to take us out. This has been
okay.
This has been
good.
Love
Extremist
Radio.
Thank you for the conversation. It's great to be talking with you, and appreciation for the work that you're doing.
Absolutely, Paul. Thank you so much. And
okay.
We'll be in touch, but have a great rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. This has been Love Extremist Radio with Paul Kivel. Hey, appreciate you for listening and hope that you comment, leave a rating in iTunes if this resonates for you, and share it with friends. It's been a really impactful conversation for me, and I really value Paul's life of work and his breadth of expertise, especially as it relates to supporting white men and being and showing up for racial justice and social justice. Have a great week. Take care.
Good morning or evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in right away. Hey, going round, breaking many hearts. Stop, be pleased before it's gone too. Possession, and it will, if we let it, destroy everybody. We all must take precautionary measures. If love and peace you treasure, then you'll hear. Breaking me.
Thanks for listening to Love Extremist Radio. If you like this podcast, please leave a rating and review on iTunes. If you want to learn more about being a love extremist, check out www.extremist.love and follow Love Extremist on Instagram and Facebook. Find me also on Instagram at Ethan Lipsitz. Hope to hear from you soon. Peace.
Love is the truth. Love is the truth. Love is the truth.